Vold Financial Group.
Hour two of your Thursday edition of Justice and Drew is underway. Welcome back to the program. 651-989-5855 is the phone number you want to take part in the program. Scott Johnson from Powerline and from Alpha News will be joining us in about 35 minutes. And then in the 8 o'clock hour, Kurt Dowd, Representative Dowd, is going to join us to talk about the continuing insanity.
Weirdness, yeah.
That is going on with DHS. People are resigning and then unresigning and then getting, you know, new commissioners, temporary commission. I don't know what's going on. We have a timeline we'll lay out for you of all the craziness that has happened.
Well, it was really funny because yesterday we had the third or fourth resignation? I think it was the third. We had the third resignation that took place, and we never, the immigration issue took over yesterday's show. It was a really, really good conversation. So if you missed any of it, be sure today to go and download the podcast via the iHeartRadio app. We talked immigration at length between 7 and 8 o'clock. So much so that we never got a chance to get to the story of the person resigning, and it was a good thing we didn't, because by the time I got home, I looked up and all the resignations, or at least two of them, had been rescinded. I was like, well, glad we didn't cover that story. I don't know what's going on.
It's a department that has gotten out of control. It's gotten too big for even our state government to manage. You know, that's the conclusion that I'm reaching anyway. It's gotten absolutely too big that nobody knows what to do with it.
We have a couple of tweets regarding Sam's top five. The last one here, we have a few more to get to. Berkeley becoming the first U.S. city to ban natural gas in new homes. Friend of the show, Narnfan, wrote, forcing the use of electric ovens on California electricity is prices. That's going to be insanely expensive. What idiots. Chad writes, if you have a stupid idea but think it is smart, you might be a Berkeley city council member.
Yeah.
What must life be like in Berkeley, man?
Nobody's ever going to know, because it's going to be too expensive to live or work there now. Seriously. They're just as if cost of living in California generally, but in the, you know, specifically in that Berkeley area, wasn't already skyrocketing through the roof. It's like they want more homeless people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody's going to be able to afford to live there.
Nope.
More of Sam's top five. Let's get right back into it.
Number four.
The DNR is calling for a loon watch after a series of suspicious deaths. From the Star Tribune, a slight uptick in reported loon deaths in the St. Louis County area, and evidence that two of the birds died from West Nile virus, has prompted state wildlife officials to encourage loon watchers to report unusual mortality. West Nile virus is common in loons, or in common loons. It isn't new in Minnesota, and more deaths from it wouldn't be preventable, but knowing the cause of death when more than one bird dies on a lake would help researchers rule out other more preventable causes. An expert on this issue, Gaia Crozer, a non-game wildlife specialist at the Department of Natural Resources in Grand Rapids, said there seems to be more calls than we normally get of loons dying off. It's enough that we're starting to wonder if there's something going on that we should be concerned about. During May and June, Crozier received reports of 8 to 10 loons dying on lakes around Britt, Eveleth, Ely, and Hibbing. In one of those cases, a small group of citizens took it upon themselves to collect the carcasses, freeze them, and deliver them to the University of Minnesota's Veterinary Diagnostic Lab in St. Paul.
So here's my first question. What were the name of the lakes? Were they racist lakes?
They died of racism.
Boy, this not a good time.
Maybe we do need to change the lake name.
Not a good time to be in the water during the summer between.
No.
I don't know what is going on.
Yeah, between all of the fecal matter in Lake Minnetonka getting everybody sick, and now loons dying. Like the land of 10,000 toxic lakes.
Wisconsin can have the title.
Right. Yeah, right. We don't want it anymore.
Yeah, Wisconsin, you can have it.
You can have the title, Wisconsin.
A veterinarian who performed the necropsies on two of the animals said the preliminary results indicate both loons died of West Nile virus. The virus, carried by mosquitoes, produces a rapidly progressing fatal disease in loons, crows, northern owls, and other birds.
All right, it is time to genocide the mosquitoes.
Yeah, yeah. I am for mosquito genocide.
There is not a bigger scourge on humanity, on this planet, than the mosquito.
And the only reason that people are just kind of like, oh, it's just mosquitoes, is because they're so tiny. Can you imagine if they were giant? Maybe people would care more.
More disease. They get more people sick.
So gross.
They kill humans and animals, and they provide zero benefit. It's not like they have this important link in the ecosystem that if the mosquito goes away, all of a sudden everything's going to crumble. They're not bumblebees. Just wipe them out.
Yeah, I don't know if it's just me. I feel like I'm overly sensitive to mosquitoes. Like when one like gets me, like
left mosquitoes off the end of that sentence.
Like I understand. But like I was mowing the lawn the other day, and I'm fine if I'm moving, but if I stop, it's like, rah, and they attack, and it was like I could instantly you know, I was like, what the so angry. Ugh.
Yeah, no, I
menaces.
I tend to be less attractive to mosquitoes than most other people. I don't know why, but my blood tastes bad, I guess.
You must stink.
I smell bad or I taste bad or something. Whatever it is, I'm fine with it and I don't want it to change.
I actually kind of in the same boat. I feel like mosquitoes don't really bother me that much. I'm just not sweet enough.
Maybe it's my thin blood. I don't know.
It takes more to fill them up.
You got to spend some time on that guy. It's thinner than most.
I've been sucking this guy's blood for 10 minutes. I mean, it's like sushi. I'm not full. You know?
Is this guy's body filled with red water? I don't understand.
Number five.
An oil tanker is missing in the Strait of Hormuz after drifting into Iranian waters. From Fox News, an oil tanker traveling through the tiny strip of water located in the mouth of the Persian Gulf stopped transmitting its location more than 2 days ago when it drifted into Iranian waters. It's not clear what happened in to the Panamanian flagged oil tanker, which is based in the United Arab Emirates, on Saturday night as it traveled through the Strait of Hormuz, but its apparent disappearance has raised concerns amid heightened tensions between Iran and several Western nations. The 190-foot oil tanker typically made trips from Dubai and Sharjah on the UAE's west coast before going through the strait and heading to an area on the UAE's east coast. Britain warned Iran after Iranian military gunboats tried and failed to seize British oil tankers. However, something happened to the vessel after 11 p.m. on Saturday when it stopped transmitting its location with tracking data, showing its last position pointing toward Iran. A captain of the data firm, Refinitiv, told the Associated Press on Tuesday that the tanker hadn't switched off its tracking in 3 months of trips around the UAE. And so he said, that is a red flag. Oil tankers have previously been targeted as the Persian Gulf region took center stage in a crisis over Iran's unraveling nuclear deal with world powers. Iranian officials have not said anything publicly about the ship, nor have officials in the UAE. The U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet, which oversees Mideast waters, declined to immediately comment.
So the latest on this is that there was a report that came out saying that Iran had seized the ship, and they had it, to which Iran responded, oh, yeah, we were helping it out. It was in distress.
It just needed a little.
So
little nudge.
We're giving it some assistance.
It needed a, you know, we needed to borrow our jumper cables.
Yeah. So it's okay. You keep saying that, Iran.
Yeah.
You're not fooling anybody.
Had a flat tire.
Had a flat
over tire. And help him out.
Yeah. Well, added the rudder. Rather, the rudder broke.
They had to borrow an oar.
They had to borrow an oar. Right.
Just a few oars.
They were short. An oar.
They shipped a propeller tooth.
Obviously something important to keep an eye on, and we will continue to monitor this.
Certainly more important than our tomfoolery.
Excellent job, Sam.
Thank you. Much to Drew's chagrin yesterday, I finally succumbed to that face app.
Oh, now Russia has your face.
That provided quite a bit of hilarity in the Justice household last night.
Yeah, so apparently this app has been around for a while. This app that you can take a selfie and it'll age you and show you presumably what you're going to look like in 30. This has been around for a long time.
It actually does a pretty good job. I feel like they all look really realistic.
It really does.
Yeah. Very realistic. I don't know how accurate, but they certainly look realistic.
I look a lot like my dad as an old person.
Yeah. But so, I don't know what, caused it to suddenly have this resurgence of popularity, because I remember this from a few years ago, this app had been out and people were doing the aging thing.
According to the story from the Independent .co UK, the app appears to have become viral because of the hashtag FaceApp Challenge, which encouraged people to load their photos into the app and then go and make them older. And then a number of celebrities have taken part in the phenomenon, Drake, Jonas Brothers, and that's how I found out about it. I mean, I was just on Facebook and I saw people that we know, Max Reimer, Brian McDaniel, had gone and posted their photos. I was like, oh, so I succumbed to downloading it yesterday and just, I was cracking up because Kyle, my 12-year-old, I threw him in there and we made him old and gave him a beard and I was just dying laughing. But there's all this concern, privacy warning issued over the app that lets the users turn them old. And so it's a Russian-owned app. Mm-hmm. It's been around for a long time. And so...
Yeah, I don't think for a second that they're not, you know, that they're not collecting and all of this data and all of this information and storing it for who knows what. I mean, maybe it's nefarious reasons. Maybe it's benign. I don't know. But every time, you know, you use that app and you upload your selfies, you know, you're giving them all of that information. You're giving them all of that data.
There was a follow-up, because the article here was FaceApp privacy warning issued over app. The app provokes shock with pictures and concern about what they could be used for. The app actually takes advantage of a feature inside your iPhone's software for iOS users. Though all of your photos will come up as options, the picture won't actually be handed over to the app until you've chosen which you want. And all the others still remain hidden. Privacy researchers digging into the hidden parts of the app have claimed there is nothing to indicate the app is taking all of the users' images. And then Care 11 actually put out a story. Did the one of their verifies? No, Facebook app doesn't send all of your photos to Russia. People just want to see what they look like when they're old. Are they unwittingly giving all their photos? And according to what they researched, that within the app itself, it says, whether you believe it or not, you know, FaceApp users are not having all their photos and data taken and uploaded by the app. Users do agree to a terms of service agreement when they open the app that gives FaceApp a lot of rights to the photos users upload, but they don't apply to everything on your phone if you believe that.
If you trust the terms of service, right. Now, here's, you know, I think people should be vigilant and should be careful about what they do and what they share and you know, what rights and permissions they give to these app developers. But where I don't get too concerned about it is Facebook's had all this stuff on a billion people for over 10 years.
Right.
And nobody seems to care.
No.
So, I mean, it's all out there. Like, any idea that you have of privacy is a complete sham. It's a complete farce. We have willingly given up. We've chosen, voluntarily given up so much privacy and so much information and so much data. It's never coming back.
I was texting with my dad in the middle of having fun with this app over something else. And I sent him the photos, and it was a group text with him and my stepmom, and they were both freaking out. And it was funny because Cindy made a really interesting point, and she goes, parents are not supposed to know what their children are going to look like when they're old. Right. And that really stuck with me for a moment. I was like, whoa, like, you're right. Like, you would never have, I mean, this app is pretty accurate. I don't want to open up this can of worms. It's just I thought was an interesting take on it, is that the app does a really good job of making people look legitimately old. And she was right. If you're a parent, you're never going to see your child looking like right. that.
It's highly unlikely.
Highly unlikely.
You would know what your child looks right. like after the age of like 65 or 70.
This app is going to cause so much just mental harm for parents.
So much distress.
So much distress. Right? It was freaky weird, man. I was cracking. We gave Kyle a beard, and I had not laughed. I don't know why. I had not laughed that hard. I'll send you the photo, Sam. It was hysterical.
I didn't need to see it.
It was so funny.
Sam, have you done this?
I have not.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you have the FaceApp app?
I do not.
I'd be curious.
I am forever young. I don't need this. I have no interest in the FaceApp.
Yeah. You're going to look so much like your mom. It's
Probably.
It's probably not even a point. You just put a picture of your mom in there.
I should do the face app. And then yesterday, I had somebody ask me, what grade are you in? I was like... I was like,
wow.
Actually, I'm like, I know I don't look old, but like, I didn't think that I look that young. And I'm often asked, like, obviously, like, I get carded everywhere I go because I do look like I'm young. But I was like, actually, I am not in high school or middle school, whatever you thought.
You can do the reverse. You can make people look young. So I wonder if you did, if you put your mom in there and then did it younger, how much you would end up looking like looking like you.
I should tell her to try it.
All right, let's switch gears. Talk a little. Drew, you mentioned it earlier. There are still 2020 Democrat candidates beyond the squad, even though they've taken over in the whole presidential run up and the nomination for the Democrat Party is completely non-existent storyline right now.
It's amazing. The slate of Democratic candidates has been completely obliterated from the news cycle right now. It's amazing. And whether or not that was intentional by Trump, I don't know. We'll never know. You know, can't read his mind. But if it was, that was a bit of a stroke of genius on his part.
So we have a tale of two stories here. The first one comes from the AP. This was after the candidates' fundraising numbers had to be released on Monday. First one is from the Associated Press, talking about Beto O'Rourke. O'Rourke's fundraising woes revive concerns about campaign. O'Rourke stormed into the presidential race, arguing his experience growing up on the southern border. 4 months into his campaign, however, the previously unknown, right, other than previously unknown, candidates are seizing on the issues that were supposed to be the former Texas congressman's strengths. Buttigieg, South Bend, Indiana mayor, became the top-tier White House candidate. He's raising a ton of money. O'Rourke's problems crystallized on Monday when he reported, raising just $3.6 million, $3.6 million during the second quarter. This is a dramatic drop, Drew, from the early days of his campaign when he raised more than $6 million in just 24 hours. It also goes on to say that O'Rourke's struggle wooing donors is perhaps the most surprising aspect of his current predicament.
I know. The media loved him so much.
Wow.
Why don't the donors? He seemed so charming and cool, and he rode skateboards. And people would say B-E-T-O.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that, too.
Yeah, they made songs about him.
They were all about him.
How could he be struggling with the fundraising when the media loved him as much as they did?
Now we have this story from Patrick Condon and Judy Keene from the Star Tribune and Amy Klobuchar. Mm-hmm. Senator Amy Klobuchar raises nearly $3.9 million, keeping her competitive.
Wait, what? Okay, hold on. Let's back up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Beto O'Rourke raised $3.6 million,
mm-hmm.
and this is being portrayed as fundraising woes that that raise serious concerns about his campaign. Amy Klobuchar raises $3.9 million, keeping her competitive.
Let's take it a step further. Beto, in the story for Beto O'Rourke, dramatic drop-off from the early days of his campaign when he raised more than $6 million.
Right.
So, again, Klobuchar raised $3.9 million. She reported raising $5.2 million at the start of her campaign.
Is that not categorized as a dramatic drop-off?
No, she's staying competitive.
She's staying competitive.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Minnesota Youth. This is the opening line of the article. Oh, right,
Minnesota media never change.
Klobuchar raises $3.9 million in her presidential bid over the past 3 months, lagging behind other leaders in the race for the 2020 Democratic nomination, but tallying enough cash to keep her on the campaign trail.
Oh, good.
She can still buy snacks for her staff, apparently.
She's gonna be the ramen candidate. You know, it's like. Just scraping by. Yeah. It's like, you know, I think I can get about 4 more miles before I run out of gas, so I think we're all right. She's going to be pulling up to the gas station going, give me $4.67 worth of gas, please. That's all I have.
Every day, it's like, today's the day. Today's the day we're going to hit.
Yeah.
Today's the day we catch fire.
The Minnesota media is so desperate to keep her in the campaign. You know, there was another, I forget who sent it out, but there was another story about how, you know, all Amy Klobuchar needs is a viral moment.
Right.
That's all she needs,
yeah.
John.
Yeah.
She needs a viral moment. Can we help? Is there anything we can do, Amy?
She needs to be the face app.
Can we do AMYK? No, that doesn't work.
No,
as well.
It doesn't. Right. Klobuchar.
03.5 FM.
dig into the latest findings regarding Ilhan Omar and the marriage immigration controversy with one of the original reporters on the subject, somebody who's been on it for many years, Scott Johnson from Powerline and with Alpha News. He joins us in the next segment. Kurt Dowd joins us in the 8 o'clock hour on 8:35 this morning to update us all on the DHS insanity.
We were talking about Klobuchar. There was one more article. So we had the two dueling articles. The one on Beto O'Rourke raising about the same amount of money as Amy Klobuchar did, even with similar fundraising dollars coming in at the start of their campaigns. The AP cast the one with Beto O'Rourke as him being negative, his campaign is failing, and of course the Star Tribune cannot help themselves saying that allows her to stay on the campaign trail and stay competitive.
Right. Very, very, very similar numbers. Even their first quarter numbers and the drop-off from the first quarter to the second quarter to their current fundraising numbers, Beto O'Rourke is cast as having serious concerns and fundraising woes. Meanwhile, according to the Star Tribune, Amy Klobuchar, she's going to keep going. She's going to stay on that presidential campaign trail.
In the meantime, subsequent article from the Tribune, Star Tribune, Senator Amy Klobuchar's presidential bid is at a crossroads, so she won't be lonely.
Oh, gosh.
She's at the crossroads. I'm sorry. Well, Bone Thugs and Harmony. Fundraising polls put her in the campaign's second tier, but she might still have time. So you got to dig in. There's a lot of nonsense
even
here.
Even second tier
right.
is generous.
It's a stretch. Klobuchar ended the second quarter with $6.7 million, spent $4.1 million, more than she raised between February 10th when she joined the race and March 31st. She raised $5.2 million. After a speech in Washington on Tuesday, Klobuchar told the Star Tribune that she was satisfied with the new numbers. "You always want more funding, but I think we're in a good place," she said. Whew, the spin has made me dizzy.
Always looking at the positive.
I'm not.
I may be low on money, but I'm not low on grit.
That's right, the grit.
I've got grit.
It's got a bank account full of grit.
Can I fill up my campaign bus gas tank with grit?
I'm not from a big state, and I have not run for president before, like Sanders or Biden. Look, you got like 35 candidates between where you are and Sanders and Biden.
Yeah.
Right? Don't talk about it like you're up in their level.
The fact is that we have 35 staff members in Iowa and 20 here in New Hampshire. That's good. I feel good. Now, here's where it gets really ugly. A CNN poll taken in New Hampshire that was released on Tuesday didn't seem promising for the Minnesota Democrat. It found that 49% in the state don't know enough about her to form an opinion or weren't sure.
Wow.
Her support,
it's just like an amorphous blob to them.
It's so bad. Her support among likely Democrat voters was at zero, down from 4% in February and 2% in April.
Is that zero? Wow.
It's nothing. Klobuchar's White House bid is at a crossroads, said Grant Woodard, a Des Moines lawyer and former political operative. "People like her. People respect her," he said. "But I don't know if people see the fire they want in a candidate at this point." No, man. Look at the squad.
You know, people saying people like her and people respect her. I mean, she has no name record. Nobody knows who she is.
No. And you go beyond that. Look at the squad right now. Right, look at AOC, Presley, Tlaib, and Omar. They're the face of the Democratic Party right now, and yeah. I'm sorry, she does not fit into that group.
If you're Amy Klobuchar, are you just seriously like seething at Ilhan Omar? The fact that like almost everybody in the country now knows who Ilhan Omar is, and she's been a representative from CD5 for a cup of coffee, and I've been a senator for a long time. I've been working really hard at this,
right?
And I've had my name floated for vice presidential positions and Supreme Court justices. I've had my PR team make sure that my name gets put in every article about every opening when Obama was president, and nobody knows who I am, and Ilhan Omar just shows up. Says a bunch of stupid stuff and is now blowing me out of the water when it comes to name recognition.
Yeah. And you know what? I will actually defend Amy Klobuchar. She has a point. I will. I almost feel bad.
Right.
I mean, for the part that, you know, Democrats suck, I almost feel bad for her.
But this is what happens when you decide to be the senator of small things.
Yes.
You decide to base your entire career around never being provocative.
Right.
around never taking a bold stance, about only speaking out on the safest of issues.
Well, back that truck up even further. This is what you get when you're a part of this party, right? This is this part. The party's been heading this way for a long, long time. And at the moment, there is no room for any moderate Democrats. Right. They just blue dog Democrats. When was the last time you heard that uttered on national TV?
They've been drubbed out of the
party. No, they're gone.
Yeah, their own base hates them.
Right. Right.
They don't want them anymore. They want the most progressive, the most extreme. They want the base, the hardcore base. You go look at like the Daily Coast crowd and the Move On crowd and all the people that sort of steer the ship and help raise the money and all that. They want nothing to do with those moderate Democrats anymore.
And going back to what we said at the start of the show and the Democrats' biggest mistake when Trump got elected of just overplaying their hand over and over and over again. Individuals, and I'm not saying that Amy Klobuchar would ever run to the right. I'm not saying that at all. But I do want to make the point that there is no place for those blue dog Democrats to go because they've overplayed their hand in criticizing Donald Trump. And right now, the narrative the left wants to paint is if you support President Donald Trump, you are a racist. Bottom line. So you've got, you know, a person like Amy Klobuchar, she's got nowhere to go right now. And it's her own fault.
Yeah, no, her presidential bid is not at a crossroads.
It's over.
It's at a three-way intersection. She's looking at the blank end. She's like, I don't know what to do.
She's Tom Hanks at the end of Castaway, just standing there. Oh no, just waiting for the delivery truck to come by to point him in the right direction. You know, I don't know which way to go now. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, that campaign bus is missing three tires.
Scott Johnson, Alpha News, and also Powerline, two outlets that have been on top of this Representative Ilhan Omar marriage history brother nonsense. We're going to dive all into that next
radio station.
Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. Is the phone number, #250 from any mobile device, and just saying TCNT will also work as well. And please keep using the hashtag TCNT on Twitter to communicate with us.
From the time since we've been talking about this issue of, and I'll go off of the Star Tribune's sort of headline about new documents revisiting questions about Representative Ilhan Omar's marriage history, right, as it relates to her brother. You know, we've been covering it on the show for quite a long time, and a lot of that has been following just the reporting that was out there. We're at a point now, at least it feels like, the controversy surrounding this is no longer the stuff of sort of taboo talk, right? It's not, right. Not the stuff that sort of, you know, like I said, we've been talking about on the air quite a bit, basically following what coverage was out there, especially from the outlets that our next guest was on. But now we're at a point where, all right, Trump's talking about Ilhan Omar. Not only is Trump talking about Ilhan Omar, Trump is actually going so far as to actually talk about this issue.
Well, there's a lot of talk about the fact that she was married to a brother. I know nothing about it. I hear she was married to a brother. You're asking me a question about it. I don't know, but I'm sure that somebody would be looking at that.
Joining us now, Scott Johnson, one of the people that from the get-go has been on top of this, has been reporting on it, has done a lot of very fantastic work on this story through Alpha News and in the Powerline blog. Good morning, Scott. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on. Let me just say I have no affiliation with Alpha News. Almost all the writing I've done on this has been at Powerline, and I've written a couple columns for the Manhattan Institute's City Journal that tried to tell the story as I saw it.
When did you first become aware of this, and when, and go, you know, walk us back to the beginning of the timeline. When was it that this started popping up on your radar and you started realizing there may be something kind of nefarious here when it comes to Ilhan Omar and her marriage history and her immigration history?
You know, there's a story there, and I tried to tell it in that City Journal column, The Curious Case of Ilhan Omar, which is still available online. And it's an interesting story. I'd never heard of her before she knocked off Phyllis Kahn in the DFL primary, you know, the 22-term incumbent, who, you know, kind of progressive legend serving the West Bank area. Omar wins the primary in early August 2016, and the Star Tribune greets it with something like a Dewey defeats Truman headline. which got my attention. And I just wrote about the result of that and how it reflected demographic changes on the West Bank and the whole little Mogadishu phenomenon. And I got a tip from a Powerline reader directing me to a kind of an inside Somali community message board called Somali Spot, which had was full of photographs and information suggesting that Omar was married to two guys, one in 2002, one in 2009, and that the second marriage was a sham that had taken place for purposes of immigration fraud. And I thought it was kind of interesting, and I puzzled about how to check it out. And I found an online marriage database, which the county or the state of Minnesota maintains, and I put in Omar's name, and the two marriages popped up just as that Somali Spot message board indicated. And I contacted the Omar campaign. I looked at her website and found that she was advertising husband number one, whom she that there was a marriage license application for online, but she was legally married to a guy who didn't appear on her website named Ahmed Elmi, and that had taken place in 2009. She was pictured with husband number one and the three kids on the website. There was no mention of this husband number two. I contacted the campaign and I sent an email to her campaign spokesman on August 12th, 2016, and they told me I'd hear back from them later that day. And at the end of the day, like around 6 o'clock at night, I got an email message from a criminal defense attorney who had represented one of the defendants in the Somali terrorism trial that I had covered in federal court in Minneapolis, not responding to my questions, but accusing me of bigotry and misogyny. And I thought, you know, it was just a classic non-response. And I thought, gee, that's kind of interesting. And I posted all that on Powerline. And as one thing led to another, it turned into a page one Star Tribune story the following week, in which, you know, it turned out that the Omar campaign convened a crisis committee, how to deal with this, what to do, what to say. And we now know what their deliberations were like, thanks to the evidence that was collected in this campaign finance board investigation, which has really been what has given the story new life last month.
Based on your investigation so far, where is your confidence level over the allegations of the details that we know? Like, are you at a place, Scott Johnson, where you can sort of take away the allegedly part of it? Like, are you convinced of anything at this point? I'm just kind of curious sort of where you stand on the legitimacy of this and how comfortable you are in saying, this is what I believe happened based off of the evidence.
With respect to the sham nature of marriage number, she entered into a marriage for fraudulent in 2009, I would put that at the 99% level of confidence. That the marriage was to her brother, I would put at about the 90% level of confidence. I really, from my perspective, kind of being injected into the middle of this story at this point with President Trump's trolling yesterday, it makes me nervous to be in the middle of a story that I think needs to be treated. You know, what it really needs is serious journalism,
right,
and not punditry. And the three people who have done serious journalism on this are me, Priya Samsunder, who was with Alpha News at the time, and David Steinberg, who wrote four fantastic investigative columns for PJ Media last year that are all available online. And he's written a fifth piece that I think we'll have up on Powerline in the next day or two. But I think the social media evidence that husband number two is her brother is very powerful. I think it's unfortunate that President Trump has injected himself now, because, of course, the whole weight of the mainstream media will come down to defend Omar, and the last thing that will take place is any honest journalism. But the Star Tribune did weigh in a page one Sunday story on June 23rd that it didn't name any of the three of us who pursued the story, but that didn't find that we'd gotten anything wrong in the past 3 years. So, you know, we're hanging out there at the end of a limb, I think, at this point, more or less together with the Star Tribune. And as I say, the only open issue, as far as I'm concerned, is whether husband number two was her brother. But let me say one fact that I think few of your listeners have probably heard, and that's that we put a copy, Priya tracked down a copy of the marriage certificate. Mm-hmm. She was actually married to Ahmed Elmi. And, you know, everything that Omar says with respect to these two marriages has elements of faith-based marriage or faith-based divorce, faith-based remarriage, faith-based re-divorce. But she was married to this guy by a Christian minister named Walisha Harris. And it just, you know, it's as phony as a $3 bill. So I doubt that your listeners have heard that. And it hasn't even been reported, for example, by the Star Tribune. And if you want to see the kind of deliberations that were going on at the Star Tribune, you can see the public relations end of it in these emails that we posted online that the Campaign Finance Board collected in its investigation of the 2016 Omar State Legislative Campaign that assures, you know, in which they were assured that the Star Tribune was not pursuing, quote, the brother angle, unquote. And why that was, when there are indicia of fraud with respect to that, I don't know, but that's where it is.
Well, yeah, and I actually, we have a version of that story, latest findings continue to provide clues into possible fraud of Ilhan Omar, one of your articles, and your quote in here, just to kind of double back to what you said about the minister, what faith tradition did Omar and Elmi invoke in 2009 for their wedding and marriage? The post is a screenshot of the image of the marriage certificate. It's signed by Walisha Harris, minister. I don't purport to know what the story is. However, I'm unaware of female imams in Omar's faith tradition or clerics in Omar's faith tradition who refer to themselves as minister. Relevant, again, in light of the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board investigation.
Walisha Harris is a minister of a Christian church. I think you can find it online. And I just think it's just an incredibly strange element of this whole story that just shouts out that there's something wrong here.
The Star Tribune has come out, though, in the past few weeks with some stories where they say there's new documents, new questions, you know, revisiting the marriage history. But a lot of it is mostly sort of just rehashing the work that you and right. Priya and David had right. done. What do you make of this, of these attempts by the Star Tribune to sort of, I don't know, I say attempts, but, you know, the Star Tribune sort of keeping this story out there, but not necessarily coming up with a whole lot of new information? Is this just a response to the documents that were released by the Campaign Finance Board that seemed to implicate some sort of ability to shut it down with respect to the Star Tribune?
I think the answer to that question is yes. You know, it's very uncomfortable for me reading that investigative file that the Campaign Finance Board made publicly available at the end of its investigation on June 6th and June 7th, which the Star Tribune didn't get around reporting on for 2 weeks. But, you know, both I and the Star Tribune are a part of the story. It's emails that I think are the most revealing part of a part of the file from the political perspective. And it shows the Star Tribune as being kind of part of the DFL establishment in the state of Minnesota. And this guy, Ben Goldfarb, who was flown in to manage the public relations component of what they treated as a public relations crisis, they being the Omar campaign, talked about being able to shut down stories with the Star Tribune. And as I say, related his assurance from the Star Tribune reporter that they were not pursuing the brother angle, to their great relief. So I think you can see a lot there, and I do think that story, which is an important contribution to this whole thing, the Star Tribune's June 23rd story by Patrick Coolican and Steve Montemayor, it's an important contribution, but I think it's a function of the evidence that's in that state campaign finance board file, which coincidentally found that Omar filed joint tax returns mm-hmm. in 2014 and 2015 with a guy to whom she was not married, while she was married to another man, which goes into this whole marriage history thing. And I mean, it's just shocking. And the Star Tribune has published that one story let me say, if Ilhan Omar were a Republican, there would be follow-up stories every day.
Oh, absolutely.
She refuses to talk to the Star Tribune. She refuses to answer their questions. She put out another statement essentially alleging that the Star Tribune was colluding with power lines in pursuing this story and trying to back them off. They're colluding with bigots.
That's funny.
It was their responsibility not to fan the flames. And you know, that statement is quoted again in the Star Tribune story today on President Trump's comments yesterday.
That's amazing.
That's been the Omar public relations strategy now for 3 years, is to back everybody off with accusations of bigotry. And I just thought it was revealing of there being a problem, a story underneath it that really warranted investigation.
That's amazing. And you're right. That has been her strategy. And it's been her strategy because, for the most part, at least here in Minnesota, it's worked. And I know you said earlier that you were concerned about President Trump bringing this issue, you know, to the forefront and putting it on the national stage. But I'm hopeful that by him doing that, you know, other media out there around the country that won't necessarily be so afraid of Ilhan Omar and the power of the, you know, bigotry accusation will actually pay attention to the work that you and David and Priya have done and start getting this, you know, the sort of coverage that it really deserves.
You know, I've been contacted by every reporter who's profiled Omar for the Bigfoot outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post and the New Yorker. And you can see how they all treat us with the back of their hand. And this is before President Trump himself. You have to breathe a sigh of relief if you're not defamed in the course of one of these articles that profile Omar and refer to the issue that we've raised and the evidence that's been compiled, mostly from social media. But, you know, I've got Somali sources, and as far as I can tell, it's an open secret in the Minneapolis Somali community that what we said occurred is, in fact, what occurred. And who's going to do that? You know, who's going to step in now and conduct an investigation with an impartial, open mind to try to ascertain what happened? Now that President Trump is, I think, is less likely now than it was 6 months ago.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about that coming up. Scott Johnson, we want to say thank you so much for taking time out this morning. Would you like to direct the listener if they want to read some of your material?
I really appreciate that. I would ask you to go to Powerline and in the search engine, just put in Omar, and it will pop up all the series of information and reporting I've been doing this year on the state campaign finance board investigation, which is just related stuff, which is just full of interesting information.
Scott Johnson, again, thank you very much. We really appreciate it, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, take care. We'll have you on again soon. And that's powerlineblog.com is the website he's referring to.
We're going to keep talking about this and also more of the squad coming up. We have some audio to share with some interviews that they did. And I'm kind of with you, and we can get a little bit more into this. I understand where Scott's coming from, but I'm of the opinion that, like we talked about before, we are at war right now. You know, a war of words in our you know, within politics. And I think that for as much as there will be if you criticize Ilhan Omar and investigate this, you're a racist. Because we're at war, there are going to be plenty of individuals and outlets out there. Mm-hmm. Now that the president has brought attention to this on a national level, that'll be more than willing to dive into this investigation.
651-989-5855. Curious about your thoughts. Got some more comments that we will